style are in heavy demand.
It could be important, said Peter. There's a builder who may be able to help, waiting to see us later.
Once again William was a little puzzled. Why did Peter think it was important to build in the style of Saint-Denis?
Walloran said, The new church will be much bigger, of course. It will protrude a good deal farther into the square here.
William did not like the proprietorial air Walloran was assuming. Now he interjected, I can't have the church encroaching on the market square.
Walloran looked irritated, as if William had spoken out of turn.
Why ever not? He said.
Every inch of the square makes money on market days.
Walloran looked as if he was disposed to argue, but Peter said with a smile, We mustn't block the silver fountain.
That's right, William said. He was paying for this church.
Happily, the fourth bad harvest had made little difference to his income. Smaller peasants paid rent in kind, and many of them had given William his sack of grain and brace of geese, even though they were living on acorn soup. Furthermore, that sack of grain was worth 10 times what it had fetched 5 years ago, and the increase in the price more than compensated for the tenants who had defaulted and the serfs who had starved to death. He still had the resources to finance the new building. They walked around to the back of the church. Here was an area of housing that generated minimal income.
William said, We can build out at this end and knock down all these houses.
But most of them are clerical residences, Walloran objected. We'll find other houses for the clergyman.
Walloran looked dissatisfied, but said no more on that subject.
On the north side of the church, a broad-shouldered man of about 30 years bowed to them. By his dress, William judged him to be a craftsman. Archdeacon Baldwin, the bishop's close colleague, said, This is the man I told you about, my lord bishop. His name is Alfred of Kingsbridge.
At first glance, the man was not very prepossessing. He was rather ox-like, big and strong and dumb. But on closer examination, there was a cunning look about his face, rather like a fox or a sly dog.
Archdeacon Baldwin said, Alfred is the son of Tom Builder, the first master at Kingsbridge, and was himself master for a while until he was usurped by his stepbrother.
The son of Tom Builder. This was the man who had married Aliena, William realized, but he had never consummated the marriage.
William looked at him with keen interest. He would never have guessed this man to be impotent. He appeared healthy and normal, but Aliena could have a strange effect on a man.
Archdeacon Peter was saying, Have you worked in Paris and learned the style of Saint-Denis?
No, but we must have a church built in the new style.
At present I'm working at Kingsbridge, where my brother is master. He brought the new style back from Paris, and I've learnt it from him.
William wondered how Bishop Walloran had managed to suborn Alfred without arousing suspicion. Then he remembered that the Kingsbridge sub-prior, Remigius, was a tool of Walloran. Remigius must have made the initial approach.
He remembered something else about Kingsbridge. He said to Alfred, But your roof fell down.
That wasn't my fault, Alfred said. Prior Philip insisted on a change of design.
I know Philip, said Peter, and there was venom in his voice. A stubborn, arrogant man.
How do you know him? William asked. Many years ago I was a monk at the cell of St. John in the Forest when Philip was in charge there. Peter said bitterly. I criticized his slack regime, and he made me almoner to get me out of the way.
Peter's resentment still burned hot, it was clear. No doubt that was a factor in whatever Walloran was scheming.
William said, Be that as it may, I don't think I want to hire a builder whose roofs fall down, no matter what excuses there might be.
Alfred said, I'm the only master builder in England who has worked on a new style church apart from Jack Jackson.
William said, I don't care about Saint-Denis. I believe my poor mother's soul will be served just as well by a traditional design.
Bishop Walloran and Archdeacon Peter exchanged a look. After a moment, Walloran spoke to William in a lowered voice.
One day, this church could be Shiring Cathedral, he said.
Everything became clear to William. Many years ago Walleran had schemed to have the seat of the diocese moved from Kingsbridge to Shiring, but Prior Philip had outmaneuvered him. Now Walleran had revived the plan. This time it seemed he would go about it more deviously. Last time he had simply asked the Archbishop of Canterbury to grant his request. This time he was going to start building a new church, one large and prestigious enough to be a cathedral, and at the same time develop allies such as Peter within the Archbishop's circle, before making his application. That was all very well, but William just wanted to build a church in memory of his mother, to ease her soul's passage through the eternal fires, and he resented Walleran's attempt to take over the scheme for his own purposes. On the other hand, it would be a tremendous boost to Shiring to have the cathedral here, and William would profit from that. Alfred was saying, "There's something else." Walleran said, "Yes?" William looked at the two men. Alfred was bigger, stronger, and younger than Walleran, and he could have knocked Walleran to the ground with one of his big hands tied behind his back. Yet he was acting like the weak man in a confrontation. Years ago it would have made William angry to see a prissy, white-skinned priest dominate a strong man. But he no longer got upset about such things. That was the way of the world. Alfred lowered his voice and said, "I can bring the entire Kingsbridge workforce with me." Suddenly his three listeners were riveted. "Say that again," said Walleran. "If you hire me as master builder, I'll bring all the craftsmen from Kingsbridge with me." Walleran said warily, "How do we know you're telling the truth?" "I don't ask you to trust me," Alfred said. "Give me the job conditionally. If I don't do what I promise, I'll leave without pay." For different reasons, all three of his listeners hated Prior Philip, and they were immediately gripped by the prospect of striking such a blow at him. Alfred added, "Several of the masons worked on Saint Denis." Walleran said, "But how can you bring them with you? Does it matter? Let's just say they prefer me to Jack." William thought Alfred was lying about this, and Walleran appeared to think the same, for he tilted back his head and gave Alfred a long look down his pointed nose. However, Alfred had seemed to be telling the truth earlier. Whatever the true reason might be, he seemed convinced that he could bring the Kingsbridge craftsmen with him. William said, "If they all follow you here, work will come to a complete standstill at Kingsbridge." "Yes," Alfred said, "it will." William looked at Walleran and Peter. "We need to talk further about this. He'd better dine with us." Walleran nodded agreement and said to Alfred, "Follow us to my house. It's at the other end of the market square." "I know," said Alfred. "I built it." For 2 days, Prior Philip refused to discuss the strike. He was speechless with rage, and whenever he saw Jack, he just turned around and walked the other way. On the second day, 3 cartloads of flour arrived from one of the priory's outlying mills. The carts were escorted by men-at-arms. Flour was as precious as gold nowadays. It was checked in by Brother Jonathan, who was deputy cellarer under old Cuthbert Whitehead. Jack watched Jonathan count the sacks. To Jack, there was something oddly familiar about Jonathan's face, as if he resembled someone Jack knew well. Jonathan was tall and gangling with light brown hair, nothing like Philip, who was short and slight and black-haired. But in every way other than physically, Jonathan took after the man who was his surrogate father. The boy was intense, high-principled, determined, and ambitious. People liked him despite his rather rigid attitude to morality, which was very much how they felt about Philip. While Philip was refusing to talk, a word with Jonathan would be the next best thing. Jack watched while Jonathan paid the men-at-arms and the carters. He was quietly efficient, and when the carters asked for more than they were entitled to, as they always did, he refused them, calmly but firmly. It occurred to Jack that a monastic education was a good preparation for leadership. Leadership. Jack's shortcomings in that area had been revealed rather starkly. He had let a problem become a crisis by maladroit handling of his men. Every time he thought of that meeting, he cursed his ineptitude. He was determined to find a way to put matters right. As the carters left, grumbling, Jack walked casually by and said to Jonathan, Philip is terribly angry about the strike. For a moment, Jonathan looked as if he was about to say something unpleasant. He was clearly fairly angry himself. But finally his face relaxed, and he said, "He seems angry, but underneath he's wounded." Jack nodded. "He takes it personally." "Yes. He feels the craftsmen have turned on him in his hour of need." "I suppose they have, in a way," Jack said. "But Philip made a major error of judgment in trying to alter working practices by fiat."
"What else could he do?"
Jonathan retorted. "He could have discussed the crisis with them first. They might even have been able to suggest some economies themselves. But I'm in no position to blame Philip, because I made the same mistake myself." That pricked Jonathan's curiosity.
"How?"
"I reported the schedule of cuts to the men as bluntly and tactlessly as Philip announced it to me." Jonathan wanted to be outraged, like Philip, and blame the strike on the perfidy of the men, but he was reluctantly seeing the other side of the coin. Jack decided to say no more. He had planted a seed. He left Jonathan and returned to his tracing floor. The trouble, he reflected, as he picked up his drawing implements, was that the town's peacemaker was Philip. Normally he was the judge of wrongdoers and the arbiter in disputes. It was disconcerting to find Philip a party in a quarrel, angry and bitter and unrelenting. Someone else was going to have to make peace this time, and the only person Jack could think of to do it was himself. As master builder, he was the go-between who could talk to both parties, and his motivation was indisputable. He wanted to continue building. He spent the rest of the day thinking about how to handle this task, and the question he asked himself again and again was, what would Philip do? On the following day he felt ready to confront Philip. It was a cold, wet day. Jack lurked around the deserted building site in the early afternoon, with the hood of his cloak pulled over his head to keep him dry, pretending to study the cracks in the clerestory, a problem that was still unsolved, and waited until he saw Philip hurry across to his own house from the cloisters. When Philip was inside, Jack followed. Philip's door was always open. Jack tapped on it and went in. Philip was on his knees in front of the small altar in the corner. You'd think he'd get enough praying done in church most of the day and half the night without doing it at home, too, Jack thought. There was no fire. Philip was economizing. Jack waited silently until Philip rose and turned around. Then Jack said, "This has to come to an end." Philip's normally amiable face was set in hard lines. "I see no difficulty about that," he said coldly. "They can come back to work as soon as they like." "On your terms." Philip just looked at him. Jack said, "They won't come back on your terms, and they won't wait forever for you to see reason." He added hastily, "or what they think is reason."
"Won't wait forever," Philip said. "Where will they go when they get tired of waiting? They won't find work elsewhere. Do they think this is the only place that is suffering from the famine? It's all over England. Every building site is having to cut back."
"So you're going to wait for them to come crawling back to you, begging forgiveness," Jack said. Philip looked away.
"I won't make anyone crawl," he said. "I don't believe I've ever given you reason to expect such behavior from me."
"No, and that's why I've come to see you," Jack said. "I know you don't really want to humiliate these men. It's not in your nature. And besides, if they returned feeling beaten and resentful, they'd work badly for years to come. So from my point of view, as well as yours, we must let them save face, and that means making concessions."
Jack held his breath. That had been his big speech, and this was his make-or-break moment. If Philip remained unmoved now, the future looked bleak.
Philip looked hard at Jack for a long moment. Jack could see reason struggling with emotion in the prior's face. Then at last his expression softened, and he said, "We'd better sit down." Jack suppressed a sigh of relief as he took a seat. He had planned what he was going to say next. He was not going to repeat the spontaneous tactlessness he had shown with the builders. "There's no need to modify your freeze on purchase of supplies," he began. "Similarly, the moratorium on new hiring can stand. No one objects to that. I also think they can be persuaded to accept that there will be no work on saints' days if they gain concessions in other areas. He paused to let that sink in. So far, he was giving everything and asking for nothing. Philip nodded. All right. What concessions? Jack took a deep breath. They were highly offended by the proposal to ban promotions. They think you're trying to usurp the ancient prerogative of the lodge.
I explained to you that that was not my intention, Philip said in an exasperated tone.
I know, Jack said hastily. Of course you did. And I believed you, but they didn't. An injured look came over Philip's face. How could anyone disbelieve him? Hastily, Jack said, But that's in the past. I'm going to propose a compromise that won't cost you anything. Philip looked interested. Jack went on, Let them continue to approve applications for promotion, but postpone the associated pay raise for a year. And he thought, Find something to object to in that, if you can.
Will they accept that? Philip said skeptically.
It's worth a try.
What if I still can't afford to pay raises a year from now?
Cross that bridge when you get to it.
You mean renegotiate in a year's time?
Jack shrugged.
If necessary.
I see, Philip said non-committally.
Anything else? The biggest stumbling block is the instant dismissal of the summer workers. Jack was being completely candid now. This issue could not be honeyed. Instant dismissal has never been allowed on any building site in Christendom. The end of the week is the earliest. To help Philip feel less foolish, Jack added, I ought to have warned you of that. So all I have to do is employ them for 2 more days.
I don't think that will be enough now, Jack said. If we'd handled it differently from the start, we might have got away with that. But now they'll want more of a compromise.
No doubt you've got something specific in mind.
Jack had, and it was the only real concession he had to ask for. It's now the beginning of October. We normally dismiss the summer workers at the beginning of December. Let's meet the men halfway and do it at the beginning of November. That only gives me half of what I need.
It gives you more than half. You still benefit from the rundown of stocks, the postponement of pay raises for promotion, and the Saints' Days.
Those things are trimmings.
Jack sat back feeling gloomy. He had done his best. He had no more arguments to put to Philip, no more resources of persuasion to deploy, nothing left to say. He had shot his arrow. And Philip was still resistant. Jack was ready to concede defeat. He looked at Philip's stony face and waited. Philip looked over at the altar in the corner for a long, silent moment. Finally, he looked back to Jack and said, I'll have to put this to the chapter. Jack went limp with relief. It was not a victory, but it was close. Philip would not ask the monks to consider anything he did not himself approve, and more often than not, they did what Philip wanted.
I hope they accept, Jack said weakly.
Philip stood up and put a hand on Jack's shoulder. He smiled for the first time. If I put the case as persuasively as you, they will, he said. Jack was surprised by this sudden change of mood. He said, The sooner this is over, the less long-term effect it will have.
I know. It's made me very angry, but I don't want to quarrel with you.
Unexpectedly, he put out his hand. Jack shook it and felt good. Jack said, Shall I tell the builders to come to the lodge in the morning to hear the chapter's verdict?
Yes, please.
I'll do that now.
He turned to go.
Philip said,
Jack.
Yes?
Thank you.
Jack nodded acknowledgement and went out. He walked through the rain without raising his hood. He felt happy. That afternoon he went to the homes of all the craftsmen and told them there would be a meeting in the morning. Those who were not at home, the unmarried men and the summer workers mostly, he found in the alehouse. However, they were sober, for the price of ale had gone up along with everything else, and no one could afford to get drunk. The only craftsman he could not find was Alfred, who had not been seen for a couple of days. Eventually he turned up at dusk. He came to the alehouse with an oddly triumphant look on his bovine face. He did not say where he had been, and Jack did not ask him. Jack left him drinking with the other men and went to have supper with Aliena and the children. Next morning he started the meeting before Prior Philip came to the lodge. He He wanted to lay the groundwork. Once again he had prepared what he had to say very carefully, to be sure he did not damage his case by tactlessness. Once again he tried to handle things as Philip might have. All the craftsmen were there early. Their livelihoods were at stake. One or two of the younger ones looked red-eyed. Jack guessed the alehouse had stayed open late last night, and some of them had forgotten their poverty for a while. The youngsters and the summer workers were most likely to prove difficult. The older craftsmen took a more long-term view. The small minority of women craftsmen were always cautious and conservative, and would back any kind of settlement. "Prior Philip is going to ask us to go back to work and offer us some kind of compromise," Jack began. "Before he comes, we ought to discuss what we might be prepared to accept, what we will definitely reject, and where we might be willing to negotiate. We must show Philip a united front. I hope you all agree." There were a few nods. He made himself sound slightly angry and said, "In my view, we should absolutely refuse to accept instant dismissal." He banged his fist on the workbench to emphasize his inflexibility on this point. Several people voiced their agreement loudly. Jack knew this was one demand Philip was certainly not going to make. He wanted the hotheads to get themselves worked up to defend ancient custom and practice on this point, so that when Philip conceded it, the wind would be taken out of their sails. "Also, we must guard the lodge's right to make promotions, for only craftsmen can judge whether a man is skilled or not." Once again he was being disingenuous. He was focusing their attention on the non-financial aspect of promotions, in the hope that when they won that point they would be ready to compromise on payments. "As for working on saints' days, I'm in two minds. Holidays are normally a matter for negotiation. There's no standard custom and practice as far as I know." He turned to Edward Two-Nose and said, "What's your view on that, Edward?" "Practice varies from site to site," Edward said. He was pleased to be consulted. Jack nodded, encouraging him to go on. Edward began to recall variant methods of dealing with saints' days. The meeting was going just the way Jack wanted. An extended discussion of a point that was not very controversial would bore the men and sap their energy for confrontation. However, Edward's monologue was interrupted by a voice from the back which said, "This is all irrelevant." Jack looked over and saw that the speaker was Dan Bristol, a summer worker. Jack said, "One at a time, please. Let Edward have his say." Dan was not so easily deflected. "Never mind about all that," he said. "What we want is a raise." "A raise?" Jack was irritated by this ludicrous remark. To his surprise, however, Dan was supported. Pierre said, "That's right, a raise. Look, a 4-pound loaf costs a penny. A hen, which used to be 8 pence, is now 24. None of us here has had strong beer for weeks, I bet. Everything is going up, but most of us are still getting the wage we were hired at, which is a 12 pence a week. We've got families to feed on that." Jack's heart was sinking. He had had everything moving along nicely, but this interruption had ruined his strategy. He restrained himself from opposing Dan and Pierre, however, for he knew he would have more influence if he appeared open-minded. "I agree with you both," he said, to their evident surprise. "The question is, what chance have we got of persuading Philip to give us a raise at a time when the priory is running out of money?" Nobody responded to that. Instead, Dan said, "We need 24 pence a week to stay alive, and even then we'll be worse off than we used to be." Jack felt dismayed and bewildered. Why was the meeting slipping out of his hands? Pierre said, 24 pence a week, and several others nodded their heads. It occurred to Jack that he might not be the only person who had come to the meeting with a prepared strategy. Giving Dan a hard look, he said, "Have you discussed this previously?" "Yes, last night in the alehouse," Dan said defiantly. "Is there anything wrong with that?" "Certainly not. But for the benefit of those of us who were not privileged to attend that meeting, would you like to summarize its conclusions?" "All right." The men who had not been at the alehouse were looking resentful, but Dan was unrepentant. Just as he opened his mouth, Prior Philip walked in. Jack threw a quick, searching look at Philip. The prior looked happy. He caught Jack's eye and gave an almost imperceptible nod. Jack felt jubilant. The monks had accepted the compromise. He opened his mouth to prevent Dan from speaking, but he was an instant too late.
"We want 24 pence a week for craftsmen," Dan said loudly. 12 pence for labourers and 48 pence for master craftsmen."
Jack looked again at Philip. The pleased look had gone, and his face had once again set in the hard, angry lines of confrontation.
"Just a moment," Jack said. "This is not the view of the lodge. It's a foolish demand cooked up by a drunken faction in the alehouse."
"No, it's not," said a new voice. It was Alfred. "I think you'll find most of the craftsmen supports the demand for double pay."
Jack stared at him in fury.
"A few months ago you begged me to give you a job," he said. "Now you're demanding double pay? I should have let you starve."
Prior Philip said, "And that's what will happen to all of you, if you don't see sense." Jack had wanted desperately to avoid such challenging remarks, but he now saw no alternative. His own strategy had collapsed.
Dan said, "We won't go back to work for less than 24 pence, and that's that."
Prior Philip said angrily,
"It's out of the question. It's a foolish dream. I'm not even going to discuss it."
"We aren't going to discuss anything else," said Dan. "We won't work for less under any circumstances."
Jack said, "This is stupid. How can you sit there and say you won't work for less? You won't work at all, you fool. You've got nowhere else to go."
"Haven't we?" said Dan.
The lodge went quiet. "Oh, God," Jack thought in despair. "This is it. They've got an alternative."
"We have got somewhere else to go," Dan said. He stood up. "And as for me, I'm going there now."
"What are you talking about?" Jack said.
Dan looked triumphant. "I've been offered work on a new site in Shiring, building the new church, at 24 pence a week for craftsmen."
Jack looked around.
"Has anyone else been offered the same?"
The whole lodge looked shamefaced.
Dan said,
"We all have."
Jack was devastated. This whole thing had been organized. He had been betrayed. He felt foolish as well as wronged. He had completely misread the situation. Hurt turned to anger, and he cast about for someone to blame.
"Which of you," he yelled, "which of you is the traitor?"
He looked around at all of them. Few were able to meet his eye. Their shame gave him no consolation. He felt like a spurned lover.
"Who brought you this offer from Shiring?" he shouted. "Who is to be the master builder at Shiring?"
His eye raked the assembled company and came to rest on Alfred.
"Of course."
He felt sick with disgust.
"Alfred," he said scornfully, "you're leaving me to work for Alfred."
There was silence. Finally Dan said,
"Yes, we are."
Jack saw that he had been defeated.
"So be it," he said bitterly. "You know me, and you know my brother, and you've chosen Alfred.
You know Prior Philip, and you know Earl William,
and you've chosen William.
All I have left to say to you is that you deserve everything you're going to get."
Chapter 15
"Tell me a story," Aliena said. "You never tell me stories anymore. Remember how you used to?"
"I remember," Jack said.
They were in their secret glade in the forest. It was late autumn, so instead of sitting in the shade by the stream, they had built a fire in the shelter of a rocky outcrop. It was a grey, cold, dark afternoon, but lovemaking had warmed them, and the fire crackled cheerfully. They were both naked under their cloaks. Jack opened Aliena's cloak and touched her breast. She thought her breasts were too big, and she was sad that they were not as high and firm as they had been before she had the children. But he seemed to love them just as much, which was a great relief. He said, "A story about a princess who lived at the top of a high castle." He touched her nipple gently. "And a prince who lived at the top of another high castle." He touched her other breast. Every day they gazed at one another from the windows of their prisons, and yearned to cross the valley between. His hand rested in the cleft between her breasts, then suddenly moved down. But every Sunday afternoon they met in the forest. She squealed, startled, then laughed at herself. These Sunday afternoons were the golden moments in a life that was rapidly falling apart. The bad harvest and the slump in the wool price had brought economic devastation. Merchants were ruined, townspeople were unemployed, and peasants were starving. Jack was still earning a wage, fortunately. With a handful of craftsmen, he was slowly erecting the first bay of the nave. But Aliena had almost completely closed down her cloth manufacturing enterprise, and things were worse here than in the rest of southern England, because of the way William was responding to the famine. For Aliena, this was the most painful aspect of the situation. William was greedy for cash to build his new church in Shiring, the church dedicated to the memory of his vicious, half-mad mother. He had evicted so many of his tenants for rent arrears that some of the best land in the county was now uncultivated, which made the shortage of grain worse. However, he had been stockpiling grain to drive the price up even farther. He had few employees and nobody to feed, so he actually profited from the famine in the short term. But in the long run, he was doing irreparable damage to the estate and its ability to feed its people. Aliena remembered the earldom under her father's rule, a rich county of fertile fields and prosperous towns, and it broke her heart. For a few years she had almost forgotten about the vows she and her brother had made to their dying father. Since William Hamley had been made earl and she had started a family, the idea of Richard winning back the earldom had become to seem a remote fantasy. Richard himself had settled down as head of the watch. He had even married a local girl, the daughter of a carpenter, although sadly the poor girl had turned out to have bad health and had died last year without giving him any children. Since the famine had started, Aliena had begun to think again about the earldom. She knew that if Richard was earl, with her help, he could do a lot to alleviate the suffering caused by the famine. But it was all a dream. William was well favoured by King Stephen, who had gained the upper hand in the civil war, and there was no prospect of a change. However, all these sorry wishes faded away in the secret glade, when Aliena and Jack lay down on the turf to make love. Right from the start they had been greedy for one another's bodies. Aliena would never forget how shocked she had been at her own lust in the beginning, and even now when she was 33 years old and childbirth had broadened her rear and made her formerly flat belly sag, still Jack was so consumed with desire for her that they would make love 3 or 4 times over every Sunday. Now his joke about the forest began to turn into a delicious caress, and Aliena pulled his face to hers to kiss him. Then she heard a voice. They both froze. Their glade was some distance from the road and concealed in a thicket. They were never interrupted except by the occasional unwary deer or bold fox. They held their breaths and listened. The voice came again, and was followed by a different one. As they strained their hearing, they picked up an undertone of rustling, as if a large group of men was moving through the forest. Jack found his boots, which were lying on the ground. Moving silently, he stepped smartly to the stream a few paces away, filled a boot with water, and emptied it on the fire. The flames went out with a hiss and a wisp of smoke. Jack moved noiselessly into the undergrowth, crouching low, and disappeared. Aliena put on her undershirt, tunic, and boots, then wrapped her cloak around her again. Jack returned as silently as he had left. "Outlaws," he said. "How many?" she whispered. "A lot. I couldn't see them all." "Where are they going?" "Kingsbridge." He held up a hand. "Listen." Aliena cocked her head. In the far distance she could hear the bell of Kingsbridge Priory tolling fast and incessantly, warning of danger. Her heart missed a beat. "Oh, Jack, the children." "We can get back ahead of the outlaws if we cross Muddy Bottom and wade the river by the chestnut wood." "Let's go quickly, then." Jack put a restraining hand on her arm and listened for a moment. He could always hear things she could not in the forest. It came of having been brought up in the wild. She waited. At last he said, "I think they've all gone by." They left the glade. After a few moments they came to the road. There was no one in sight. They crossed the road and cut through the woods, following a barely perceptible track. Aliena had left Tommy and Sally with Martha playing Nine Men's Morris in front of a cheerful fire. She was not quite sure what the danger was, but she was terrified that something might happen before she reached her children. They ran when they could, but to Aliena's frustration the ground was too rough for most of the way, and the best she could do was jog trot, while Jack walked with a long-legged stride. This route was harder going than the road, which was why they did not normally use it, but it was much quicker. They slithered down the steep slope that led to Muddy Bottom. Unwary strangers were occasionally killed in this bog, but there was no danger to those who knew their way across. Nevertheless, the waterlogged mud seemed to grasp Aliena's feet, slowing her down, keeping her from Tommy and Sally. At the far side of Muddy Bottom was a ford across the river. The cold water came up to Aliena's knees and washed the mud from her feet. From there the route was straightforward. The alarm bell sounded louder as they approached the town. Whatever danger the town faced from the outlaws, at least they had somehow been forewarned, Aliena thought, trying to keep her spirits up. As she and Jack emerged from the forest into the meadow across the river from Kingsbridge, 20 or 30 youngsters who had been playing football in a nearby village arrived at the same time, shouting raucously and perspiring despite the cold. They hurried across the bridge. The gate was already closed, but the people on the battlements had seen and recognized them, and as they approached, a small sallyport was opened. Jack pulled rank and made the boys let him and Aliena in first. They ducked their heads and went through the small doorway. Aliena was deeply relieved to have got back to the town before the outlaws. Panting with their exertions, they hurried up the main street. The townspeople were taking to the walls with spears, bows, and piles of stones to throw. The children were being rounded up and taken to the priory. Martha would have gone there already with Tommy and Sally, Aliena decided. She and Jack went straight to the priory close. In the kitchen courtyard, Aliena saw, to her astonishment, Jack's mother, Ellen, as lean and brown as ever, but with grey in her long hair and wrinkles around her 44-year-old eyes. She was talking animatedly to Richard. Prior Philip was some distance away, directing children into the chapter house. He did not seem to have seen Ellen. Standing nearby was Martha with Tommy and Sally. Aliena gasped with relief and hugged the two children. Jack said, "Mother, why are you here? I came to warn you that a gang of outlaws is on the way. They're going to raid the town." "We saw them in the forest," Jack said. Richard's ears pricked up. "You saw them? How many men?" "I can't be sure, but it sounded like a lot, at least 100, maybe more." "What sort of weapons? Clubs? Knives? A hatchet or two? Mostly clubs." "What direction?" "North of here." "Thanks. I'm going to take a look from the walls." Aliena said, "Martha, take the children into the chapter house." She followed Richard, as did Jack and Ellen. As they hurried through the streets, people kept saying to Richard, "What is it?" "Outlaws," he would say succinctly, without breaking his stride. Richard was at his best like this, Aliena thought. Ask him to go out and earn his daily bread, and he was helpless. But in a military emergency, he was cool, level-headed, and competent. They reached the north wall of the city and climbed the ladder to the parapet. There were heaps of stones for throwing down on the attackers, placed at regular intervals. Townsmen with bows and arrows were already taking up positions on the battlements. Some time ago, Richard had persuaded the town guild to hold emergency drills once a year. There had been a lot of resistance to the idea at first, but it had become a ritual, like the Midsummer Play, and everyone enjoyed it. Now its real benefits were showing as the townspeople reacted quickly and confidently to the sound of the alarm. Aliena looked fearfully across the fields to the forest. She could see nothing. Richard said, "You must have got here well ahead of them." Aliena said, "Why are they coming here?" Ellen said, "The priory storehouses. This is the only place for miles around where there's any food." "Of course." The outlaws were hungry people dispossessed of their land by William, with no way to live but theft. In the undefended villages there was little or nothing to steal. The peasants were not much better off than the outlaws. Only in the barns of landowners was their food in quantity. As she was thinking this, she saw them. They emerged from the edge of the forest like rats from a burning hayrick. They swarmed across the field toward the town. 20, 30, 50, 100 of them, a small army. They had probably hoped to catch the town unawares and get in through the gates. But when they heard the bell ringing the alarm, they realized they had been forestalled. Nevertheless, they came on with the desperation of the starving. One or two bowmen loosed off premature arrows, and Richard yelled, "Wait! Don't waste your shafts!" Last time Kingsbridge was attacked, Tommy had been 18 months old, and Aliena was pregnant with Sally. She had taken refuge in the priory then with the elderly and the children. This time she would stay on the battlements and help to fight off the danger. Most of the other women felt the same way. There were almost as many women as men on the walls. All the same, Aliena felt torn as the outlaws came closer. She was near the priory, but it was possible that the attackers could break through at some other point and reach the priory before she could get there. Or she might be injured in the fighting and unable to help the children. Jack was here, and so was Ellen. If they should be killed, only Martha would be left to take care of Tommy and Sally. Aliena hesitated, undecided. The outlaws were almost at the walls. A shower of arrows fell on them, and this time Richard did not tell the archers to wait. The outlaws were decimated. They had no armor to protect them. There was also no organization. No one had planned the attack. They were like stampeding animals rushing headlong at a blank wall. When they got there, they did not know what to do. The townspeople bombarded them with stones from the battlements. Several outlaws attacked the north gate with clubs. Aliena knew the thickness of that iron-bound oak door. It would take all night to break through. Meanwhile, Alf Butcher and Arthur Sadler were maneuvering a cauldron of boiling water from someone's kitchen up onto the wall over the gate. Directly below Aliena, a group of outlaws started to form a human pyramid. Jack and Richard immediately started to throw stones at them. Thinking of her children, Aliena did the same, and Ellen joined in too. The desperate outlaws withstood the hail of rocks for a while. Then someone was hit on the head, the pyramid collapsed, and they gave up. There were screams of pain from the north gate a moment later, as the boiling water poured on the heads of the men attacking the door. Then some of the outlaws realized that their dead and wounded comrades were easy prey, and they started to strip the bodies. Fights broke out with those who were not so badly wounded, and rival looters quarreled over the possessions of the dead. It was a shambles, Aliena thought, a disgusting, degrading shambles. The townspeople stopped throwing stones as the attack petered out, and the attackers fought among themselves like dogs over a bone. Aliena turned to Richard. "They're too disorganized to be a real threat," she said. He nodded. "With a little help, they could be quite dangerous, because they're desperate. But as it is, they've no leadership." Aliena was struck by a thought. "An army waiting for a leader," she said. Richard did not react, but she was excited by the idea. Richard was a good leader who had no army. The outlaws were an army without a leader, and the earldom was falling apart. Some of the townspeople continued to throw stones and shoot arrows at the outlaws, and more of the scavengers fell. This was the final discouragement, and they began to retreat like a pack of dogs with their tails between their legs, looking back over their shoulders regretfully. Then someone opened the north gate, and a crowd of young men charged out, brandishing swords and axes, and went after the stragglers. The outlaws fled, but some were caught and butchered. Ellen turned away in disgust and said to Richard, "You should have stopped those boys from giving chase." "Young men need to see some blood after a set-to such as this," he said. "Besides, the more we kill this time, the fewer we'll have to fight next time." It was a soldier's philosophy, Aliena thought. In the time when she had felt her life threatened every day, she would probably have been like the young men, and chased after outlaws to slaughter them. Now she wanted to wipe out the causes of outlawry, not the outlaws themselves. Besides, she had thought of a way to use those outlaws. Richard told someone to sound the all-clear on the priory bell, and gave instructions for a double watch for the night, with patrolling guards as well as sentries. Aliena went to the priory and collected Martha and the children. They all met again at Jack's house. It pleased Aliena that they were all together, she and Jack and their children and Jack's mother and Aliena's brother and Martha. It was quite like an ordinary family, and Aliena could almost forget that her father had died in a dungeon, and she was legally married to Jack's stepbrother, and Ellen was an outlaw, and... She shook her head. It was no use pretending this was a normal family. Jack drew a jug of ale from the barrel and poured it into large cups. Everyone felt tense and excited after the danger. Ellen built up the fire, and Martha sliced turnips into a pot, beginning to make a broth for supper. Once upon a time they would have put half a pig on the fire on a day such as this. Richard drank his ale in one long swallow, wiped his mouth, and said, "We're going to see more of this kind of thing before the winter's out." Jack said, "They should attack Earl William's storehouses, not Prior Philip's. It's William who has made most of these people destitute."
They won't have any more success against William than they did against us, unless they improve their tactics. They're like a pack of dogs.
Aliena said, They need a leader. Jack said, Pray they never get one. They would really be dangerous then.
Aliena said, A leader might direct them to attack William's property instead of ours.
I don't follow you, Jack said.
Would a leader do that?
He would if he was Richard.
They all went quiet. The idea had grown in Aliena's mind, and she was now convinced it could work. They could fulfill their vows, Richard could destroy William and become the Earl, and the county could be restored to peace and prosperity. The more she thought about it, the more excited she became. She said, There were more than 100 men in that rabble today. She turned to Ellen. How many more are there in the forest?
Countless, Ellen said. Hundreds, thousands.
Aliena leaned across the kitchen table and locked eyes with Richard.
Be their leader, she said forcefully. Organize them, teach them how to fight, devise plans of attack. Then send them into action against William.
As she spoke, she realized that she was telling him to put his life in danger, and she was filled with trepidation. Instead of winning back the earldom, he could be killed. But he had no such qualms.
By God, Ali, you could be right, he said.
I could have an army of my own and lead it against William.
Aliena saw in his face the flush of a hatred long nurtured, and she noticed again the scar on his left ear, where the lobe had been sliced off. She pushed down the vile memory that threatened to surface. Richard was warming to his theme. I could raid William's herds, he said with relish. Steal his sheep, poach his deer, break open his barns, rob his mills. My God, I could make that vermin suffer if I had an army.
He had always been a soldier, Aliena thought. It was his fate.
Despite her fear for his safety, she was thrilled by the prospect that he might have another chance to fulfill his destiny. He thought of a snag. But how can I find the outlaws? He said. They always hide.
I can answer that, said Ellen.
Branching off the Winchester Road is an overgrown track that leads to a disused quarry. That's their hideout. It used to be known as Sally's quarry.
7-year-old Sally said, But I haven't got a quarry.
Everyone laughed. Then they went quiet again. Richard looked exuberant and determined.
Very well, he said tightly. Sally's quarry.
We'd been working hard all morning, uprooting a massive tree stump up the hill, said Philip. When we came back, my brother Francis was standing right there in the goat pen, holding you in his arms. You were a day old.
Jonathan looked grave. This was a solemn moment for him. Philip surveyed the cell of St. John in the forest. There was not much forest in sight now. Over the years the monks had cleared many acres, and the monastery was surrounded by fields. There were more stone buildings, a chapter house, a refectory, and a dormitory, plus a host of smaller wooden barns and dairies. It hardly looked like the place he had left 17 years ago. The people were different, too. Several of those young monks now occupied positions of responsibility at Kingsbridge. William Bovis, who had caused trouble by flicking hot candle wax at the novice master's bald head all those years ago, was now prior here. Some had gone. That troublemaker, Peter of Wareham, was in Canterbury, working for an ambitious young archdeacon called Thomas Becket.
I wonder what they were like, said Jonathan. I mean my parents.
Philip felt a twinge of pain for him. Philip himself had lost his parents, but not until he was 6 years old, and he could remember them both quite well. His mother calm and loving, his father tall and black-bearded and, to Philip anyway, brave and strong. Jonathan did not even have that. All he knew about his parents was that they had not wanted him.
We can guess a lot about them, Philip said.
Really?
Jonathan said eagerly.
What?
They were poor, Philip said. Wealthy people have no reason to abandon their children. They were friendless. Friends know when you're expecting a baby and ask questions if a child disappears. They were desperate. Only desperate people can bear to lose a child.
Jonathan's face was taut with unshed tears. Philip wanted to weep for him, this boy who, everyone said, was so much like Philip himself. Philip wished he could give him some consolation, tell him something warm and heartening about his parents. But how could he pretend that they had loved the boy when they had left him to die?
Jonathan said, But why does God do such things?
Philip saw his opportunity. Once you start asking that question, you can end up in confusion. But in this case, I think the answer is clear. God wanted you for himself.
Do you really think so?
Have I never told you that before? I've always believed it. I said so to the monks here on the day you were found. I told them that God had sent you here for a purpose of his own, and it was our duty to raise you in God's service, so that you would be fit to perform the task he has assigned you.
I wonder if my mother knows that.
If she's with the angels, she does.
What do you think my task might be?
God needs monks to be writers, illuminators, musicians, and farmers. He needs men to take on the demanding jobs, such as cellarer, prior, and bishop. He needs men who can trade in wool, heal the sick, educate the schoolboys, and build churches.
It's hard to imagine that he has a role cut out for me.
I can't imagine he would have gone to this much trouble with you if he didn't, Philip said with a smile. However, it might not be a grand or prominent role in worldly terms. He might want you to become one of the quiet monks, a humble man who devotes his life to prayer and contemplation.
Jonathan's face fell. I suppose he might.
Philip laughed, but I don't think so. God wouldn't make a knife out of wood or a lady's chemise out of shoe leather. You aren't the right material for a life of quietude, and God knows it. My guess is that he wants you to fight for him, not sing to him.
I certainly hope so.
But right now I think he wants you to go and see Brother Leo and find out how many cheeses he has for the cellar at Kingsbridge.
Right.
I'm going to talk to my brother in the chapter house, and remember, if any of the monks speak to you about Francis, say as little as you can.
I shall say nothing. Off you go.
Jonathan walked quickly across the yard. His solemn mood had left him already, and his natural exuberance had returned before he reached the dairy. Philip watched him until he disappeared into the building.
I was just like that, except perhaps not so clever, he thought.
He went the opposite way, to the chapter house. Francis had sent a message asking Philip to meet him here discreetly. As far as the Kingsbridge monks were concerned, Philip was making a routine visit to a cell. The meeting could not be kept from the monks here, of course, but they were so isolated they had nobody to tell. Only the prior of the cell ever came to Kingsbridge, and Philip had sworn him to secrecy. He and Francis had arrived this morning, and although they could not plausibly claim that the meeting was an accident, they were maintaining a pretense that they had organized it only for the pleasure of seeing one another. They had both attended High Mass, then taken dinner with the monks. Now was their first chance to talk alone. Francis was waiting in the chapter house, sitting on a stone bench against the wall. Philip almost never saw his own reflection. There were no looking glasses in a monastery, so he measured his own aging by the changes in his brother, who was only 2 years younger. Francis, at 42, had a few threads of silver in his black hair, and a crop of stress lines around his bright blue eyes. He was much heavier around the neck and waist than last time Philip had seen him.
I've probably got more grey hair and less surplus fat, Philip thought, but I wonder which of us has more worry lines.
He sat down beside Francis and looked across the empty octagonal room. Francis said, "How are things?"
"The savages are in control again," Philip said. "The priory is running out of money. We've almost stopped building the cathedral. Kingsbridge is on the decline. Half the county is starving, and it's not safe to travel."
Francis nodded. "It's the same story all over England."
"Perhaps the savages will always be in control," Philip said gloomily. "Perhaps greed will always outweigh wisdom in the councils of the mighty. Perhaps fear will always overcome compassion in the mind of a man with a sword in his hand."
"You're not usually so pessimistic."
"We were attacked by outlaws a few weeks ago. It was a pitiable effort. No sooner had the townsmen killed a few than the outlaws started fighting among themselves. But when they retreated, the young men of our town chased after the poor wretches and slaughtered all they could catch. It was sickening."
Francis shook his head. "It's hard to understand."
"I think I do understand it. They'd been frightened and could only exorcise their fear by shedding the blood of the people who had scared them. I saw that in the eyes of the men who killed our mother and father. They killed because they were scared. But what can take away their fear?"
Francis sighed. Peace, justice, prosperity. Hard things to achieve.
Philip nodded. Well, what are you up to?
I'm working for the son of the Empress Maud. His name is Henry.
Philip had heard talk of this Henry. What's he like?
He's a very clever and determined young man. His father is dead, so he's Count of Anjou. He's also Duke of Normandy, because he's the eldest grandson of old Henry, who used to be King of England and Duke of Normandy. And he's married Eleanor of Aquitaine, so now he's Duke of Aquitaine as well.
He rules over more territory than the King of France.
Exactly.
But what's he like?
Educated, hard-working, fast-moving, restless, strong-willed. He has a fearsome temper.
I sometimes wish I had a fearsome temper, Philip said. It keeps people on their toes. But everyone knows I'm always reasonable, so I'm never obeyed with quite the same alacrity as a prior who might explode at any minute.
Francis laughed. Stay just the way you are, he said. He became serious again.
Henry has made me realize the importance of the king's personality. Look at Stephen. His judgment is poor. He's determined in short bursts, then he gives up. He's courageous to the point of foolishness, and he pardons his enemies all the time. People who betray him risk very little. They know they can count on his mercy. Consequently, he struggled unsuccessfully for 18 years to rule a land that was a united kingdom when he took it over. Henry already has more control over his collection of previously independent duchies and counties than Stephen has ever had here. Philip was struck by an idea. Why did Henry send you to England? He said.
To survey the kingdom? What have you found? That it is lawless and starving, battered by storms and ravaged by war.
Philip nodded thoughtfully.
Young Henry was Duke of Normandy because he was the eldest son of Maud, who was the only legitimate child of old King Henry, who had been Duke of Normandy and King of England. By that line of descent, young Henry could also claim to be King of England. His mother had made the same claim and had been opposed because she was a woman and because her husband was an Angevin. But young Henry was not only male, but had the additional merit of being both Norman on his mother's side and Angevin on his father's. Philip said, "Is Henry going to try for the crown of England?"
"It depends on my report," said Francis.
"And what will you tell him? That there will never be a better time than now."
"Praise God," said Philip.
2. On his way to Bishop Walleran's castle, Earl William stopped at Cowford Mill, which he owned. The miller, a dour middle-aged man called Wulfric, had the right to grind all the grain grown in 11 nearby villages. As his fee, he kept 2 sacks in every 20, one for himself and one for William. William went there to collect his dues. He did not normally do this personally, but these were not normal times. Nowadays he had to provide an armed escort for every cart carrying flour or anything else edible. In order to use his people in the most economical way, he was in the habit of taking a wagon or two with him whenever he moved around with his entourage of knights, and collecting whatever he could. The surge in outlaw crime was an unfortunate side effect of his firm policy on bad tenants. Landless people often turned to theft. Generally, they were no more efficient as thieves than they had been as farmers, and William had expected most of them to die off during the winter. At first, his expectations had been borne out. The outlaws either went for lone travellers who had little to be stolen, or they carried out ill-organized raids on well-defended targets. Lately, however, the outlaws' tactics had improved. Now they always attacked with at least double the numbers of the defending force. They came when barns were full, a sign that they were reconnoitering carefully. Their attacks were sudden and swift, and they had the courage of desperation. However, they did not stay to fight, but each man fled as soon as he had got his hands on a sheep, a ham, a cheese, a sack of flour, or a bag of silver. There was no point in pursuing them, for they melted into the forest, dividing up and running always. Someone was commanding them, and he was doing it just the way William would have. The outlaw's success humiliated William. It made him look like a buffoon who could not police his own earldom. To make matters worse, the outlaws rarely stole from anyone else. It looked as if they were